You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. Will Catalonia or won't it? And should Catalonia or shouldn't it? My guests John Everard and Sebastian Borger will be here to discuss this and the day's other top stories, including whether or not banning four ships from the world's ports will bring North Korea to heel, Liberia's first peaceful transfer of power in more than 70 years, and...
I'm very proud of it. It's fulfilled its purpose, and its purpose was not to glorify me, it was to make a statement of outrage at the murder of Che Guevara and to make sure his memory was kept.
Why has Ireland put Che Guevara on a postage stamp? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea and elsewhere. Welcome both. We will start with John's former bailiwick of North Korea. If, and this is a big if, of dimensions sufficient to dwarf Mount Paektu itself, Donald Trump has been right in any respect about North Korea, it's that previous attempts to correct its behaviour have not turned it into a model global citizen. Is it possible then that the banning from all global ports of ships involved in breaking sanctions, rather, will help? The UN appears to think so. Four vessels, count them, four, bearing various flags are now without safe harbour following the imposition of exactly this ban. John, what do we know about these four ships?
A great deal. Anybody who has had the sad experience of ploughing through the reports by the United Nations panel of experts showing how the North Koreans breach sanctions will recognise the names of these ships immediately. These are serial transgressors. They appear in instant after instant, and they keep renaming themselves, reflagging themselves, re-registering themselves. But these are clearly part of the North Korean effort to break out of its sanctions. So they were obvious targets for the Security Council to be banned from all ports. And the action is stiff. To actually prevent a vessel from entering any port anywhere renders it obviously effectively useless. The only ports that they can actually get into now are their home ports, and that doesn't do them a great deal of good.
Indeed not. Sebastian, is there potentially, do we think here, a way forward in dealing with North Korea than rather the big sweeping sanctions and threats we've seen, than just continually making it just incrementally more difficult for the state to function?
Well, that's one way. Of course, we worry about the tipping point, don't we? When what happens if or when these sanctions actually bite? What happens? I mean,
the North Koreans have told us what happens.
Well, exactly.
The world collapses, and they will fight back against the imperialist blockade.
They fire all sorts of missiles all over the place. So. It's a fine balance, isn't it? You'd want, in a way, you'd want to have sanctions, but you want some sort of dialogue as well again, and that doesn't seem to happen as far as we know.
No, indeed, there's been a lot of talk about dialogue. A lot of my colleagues have been trying to establish whether there has been sort of secret, track one direct dialogue between the United States and North Korea. The answer appears to be no. We've had various near misses. I mean, we all know about the meeting back in, I think it was May, where Joseph Yun got the hapless Otto Warmbier out. So that was direct contact, but we're pretty sure that they didn't discuss anything except, the release of detainees. There was a meeting in Switzerland last month that got nowhere. The North Koreans simply refused to talk about the nuclear programs. There's one scheduled for Norway later this month, track 1.5, so unofficial on the American side, official on the North Korean side, but the trouble is that's now leaked, not least because I've told everybody, so it'll either, if it does happen, it's going to get rescheduled and the venue will now change, but nobody's holding out any great hopes. The North Koreans quite simply are not talking.
John, is there an element of, I guess, diplomatic jiu-jitsu here, or whatever more appropriately Korean martial art would be?
Taekwondo.
Taekwondo, for example, in that measured against various sanctions and punishments imposed on North Korea, this doesn't seem like that big a deal, so it would make any response that they may happen to make look somewhat disproportionate and ridiculous.
Yes, but they are, part of their doctrine is disproportionate response. You lash out against the imperialists, you make sure that they never dare to infringe your sovereignty again. So, the answer to the question is yes, but that's what they do.
So how might they respond to something like this?
I suspect that they will look for a response that is just below what they think might be US and, for that matter, wider Western trigger lines. A cyber attack is quite likely. Perhaps they'll go looking for a further American hostage somewhere, although now that there's the travel ban in place, it's much more difficult for them to round up Americans. We can expect certainly a fiery speech. It was interesting that the North Koreans attended the meeting where this port ban was announced on these four ships and didn't say anything. Clearly, Pyongyang hasn't got its line out yet. They haven't yet worked out exactly what to do, so the diplomats were silenced. But I don't think that will last very long.
And China? What is China doing all the time?
China let this through.
I always worry about.
Yes, China
let the sanctions through, but they're not doing anything, are they, towards a proper, a meaningful dialogue of any sort?
No, not for lack of trying. I mean,
you reckon?
It's quite clear from what's going on in Beijing and in Pyongyang that it's not just Washington that can't get the North Koreans to talk. The North Koreans are furious with China. They have published a series of very, very rude editorials about China's betrayal, as they see it. And any Chinese who pour half a whiskey down will wring his hands and say, we keep trying to talk sense to these guys. Ever since Zhang Songtek went, we have no serious access at top levels in Pyongyang. At lower levels, they'll hear us out politely, they'll ignore us. We have no traction.
You believe them?
Yes, I do.
Sebastian, do you get the sense that there is, and this is a bit of an evergreen question where North Korea is concerned, do you get the sense that there is as yet any long-term coherent strategy? Does anybody involved in trying to deal with North Korea, by which I mean, I guess, trying to get North Korea to behave slightly less like North Korea, does anybody yet understand how they're going to do that or what the endpoint might look like?
For once in my life, or at least tonight, I shall give some credit to Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump recently tweeted, nothing has worked, and that's true. You know,
well, he did say only one thing will work, but he didn't.
We don't know what he meant.
He didn't elaborate on what that one thing might be. Almost as if he's got no idea what he's actually talking about, John.
Yes. There's the thought.
Seriously, we've had all sorts of, John knows that much better than I, but we've had all sorts of two-party and four-party and six-party and all or whatever party talks for a quarter of a century now. And they have step by step moved closer to not only the nuke, which they have, but also to the intercontinental ballistic missile. So there is, I suppose, a point where you say either you let it happen or you do something more drastic.
And the trouble is that you can't let it happen. I mean, there's been a lot of loose talk about North Korea becoming like India or Pakistan, perhaps, where everybody knows they have nuclear weapons.
Or Israel.
Or Israel also, they have nuclear weapons, but of course they're not formally nuclear weapon states under the NPT, and the world just lives with this. But the trouble with North Korea is that they have said publicly and at high level that when they have these weapons, they are not just going to sit pat. This is part of a longer term scheme to overcome the South. So that you're just, you've got the run-up to the actual use and use weapons for territorial conquest.
Okay, well, let's move along now and take a look at Ireland. And one might think that Ireland would be more sensitive than most to the crass folly of witlessly romanticising someone else's revolutionary heritage and making claims upon a national identity on the basis of desperately thin connections. Nevertheless, Ireland's post office has gone ahead and issued a €1 stamp to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the death of Che Guevara, great-great-great-great-grandson of one Patrick Lynch of Galway, I'm not making that up, prompting a measure of anguish among Cuban Americans who do not consider Guevara's legacy of ideologically motivated mayhem an entirely positive one. John, I'm tempted to ask, is this a bit like Cuba putting Jerry Adams on a stamp? But of course, that would be entirely unsurprising, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it would. but yes, actually, the analogy is a rather a good one. It is of that order. I mean, it is a crazy thing to do. I mean, firstly, as you just said, Che Guevara's links with Ireland are tenuous in the extreme.
I've been doing some sums here. I think I've got this calculated correctly. I am precisely four times the Irishman that Che Guevara was. I think that's accurate.
Perhaps congratulations.
Possibly twice. And do you see them putting me on a stamp?
I'd be right behind it, Andrew.
You do not. It's outrageous. Sebastian, is this a bit crass, do you think?
I don't have any Irish blood, unfortunately. Well, I think to make a serious point here, it's so interesting that Che Guevara still seems to be an icon for a whole generation and young people growing up with his image and putting it on their T-shirts. When I think, the Cuban Revolution, that's my reading of history, was necessary and a good thing for the country. But anything that he did after that and even in Cuba turned into a dictatorship, but the whole thing in Bolivia was completely botched. And why are we celebrating him?
Not only was it botched, it was needlessly violent. It was vindictive. It was vicious. I mean, Che Guevara, stripped of the myth, was a deeply unpleasant person, and certainly the last person I'd ever want to lick his back and put in my letters.
It is an odd one, isn't it? I mean, I think we do all appear to be agreed that he was basically a happy shopper Leon Trotsky. But and I do kind of wonder whenever you see somebody with their image on his T-shirt, how detailed a précis of his life and accomplishments they'd be able to give you if you ask them. But, I mean, Sebastian, is it just because Alberto Korda took that one photo of him, gazing sort of loftily into the middle distance, in which he admittedly does look incredibly cool? Yeah. He's a good-looking fella.
Yeah.
But is it just that one photo? And that's all that there actually is underpinning the legend?
Well, as you alluded to, I think if you ask 10 people who wear his image, who was he, what did he do, I think at least half wouldn't be able to tell you. It's that kind of iconic image which it could be anybody, really.
It's not just the photo, it was the fact that he took the sensible decision to die young, so that nobody actually discovered.
Always helpful.
Decision was rather made for him by the CIA, in fairness.
It was, that's right, and by various people sort of putting bits of lead through him, true. But the fact that he died young meant that the world never had to confront Che Guevara in middle age or old age, and the tyrant he would probably have become. I mean, if he had died young, Fidel Castro might have remained an icon. Of course, we were then...
Well, Fidel Castro did. I mean, that's the thing. I mean,
die young?
Well, he didn't die young. No, he died incredibly old. But he did retain this extraordinary sentimental pull on large numbers of people who you would.
But
hope
they wouldn't put
would
it.
Would
put
better.
Him on their T-shirts, would they?
Or their stamps?
Probably. Their stamps. I'm sure he's been on postage stamps outside Cuba, Castro. But I mean, John. I mean, there's an interesting compare and contrast here. I think in that there remains across huge swaths of the Western left this incredible sappy fondness for the Cuban Revolution and an incredible willingness to forgive its excesses, which were excessive. And yet you don't find many people willing to make the same excuses for North Korea. What is the difference? Is it just the palm trees and the cigars?
The palm trees and the cigars probably softened the edges quite nicely. That is true. Also, the international presentation, Fidel Castro's Cuba, was very, very good at presenting itself in a favourable light to sympathetic international media. North Korea simply was a hermit country that nobody knew anything about until black ideas started to emerge. Also, North Korea is much more repressive than Cuba ever was. Yeah. I mean, not that I'm holding a candle for the Cuban regime,
no.
Please, but if you compare the two, North Korea is a great deal worse.
I mean, the Cubans never ate grass, did they?
I don't think it was entirely easy for them, but I don't think there was ever widespread famine on the scale that there certainly has been in North Korea.
No.
But Sebastian, and this is where I shamelessly project my own opinions onto the guest, does it not seem weird, that point I raised in the introduction, that given that Ireland itself has had a history of revolutionary struggle which has been somewhat witlessly and ignorantly appropriated by people from around the world who really don't know the first thing about it, they should be more
sensitive? Not least the Germans?
Well, they should be more sensitive about things like this.
Oh. Well, I mean, I of course had to report on their 100 years anniversary of the Easter Rising last year, and I mean the Irish have a very romanticized view of their history and how how useful the whole thing was, and I suppose that's this stamp is part of it. I mean, it seems a little bit childish to me.
I'm also not sure how much genuine outrage it is eliciting among the Cuban American community. The news stories do appear to come down to a couple of angry quotes from one somewhat excitable radio host. John, would you take this personally, do you think?
If I were a Cuban exile, I think, yes, anything to do with Che Guevara probably would touch a nerve. Having a supposedly friendly nation state put his face on their 1 euro stamp certainly would, yes. I mean, I might not sort of burst into print over it or sort of, you know, say rude things on the radio, but I think I'd probably grumble at least in private.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Sebastian Borger and John Everard. Coming up next, is George Weah about to complete the FIFA World Player of the Year, president of his country, double?
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Sebastian Borger and John Everard. Now, the first election of any new democracy is always celebrated, and quite rightly. It's arguable, however, that the more important election in any democracy's history is the second one. You only find out if democracy has stuck when power is transferred peacefully. Liberia has not managed this in 73 years of trying, but the country is voting today for a successor to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The main contenders to replace her are Vice President Joseph Boakai and George Weah, late of Paris Saint-Germain, AC Milan, Manchester City and Chelsea, among others. John, first of all, the very fact of President Sirleaf stepping down because she's term limited, how important is that?
Very, very important. Somebody in West Africa actually obeying a constitution. I mean, this is not an absolute first, but it is a landmark. I mean, you know, Senegal has been through this and had a peaceful transition. The Gambia, of course, has just been through a slightly sort of messy version of the same thing. But Liberia? Free elections in Liberia? I'm still pinching myself. I mean, I remember when I used to deal with Liberia as a diplomat, we always sort of thought, yes, if the Americans can somehow fix it, that Sirleaf becomes president, you know, she might last for a few months before she's found sort of dead in her bed one day and Liberia goes back to its old ways. Two full terms later, after she's done great things for that country, I mean, there's still a great deal to do, sure. We have what elections that as of half an hour ago, were being conducted peacefully, freely. We'd have no reason to doubt that the count will be done fairly. This is a minor miracle. This is an extraordinary event.
Two full terms and a Nobel Peace Prize later for President Sirleaf, Sebastian. How do we assess her legacy?
So, in a way, we're now having the third elections, aren't we? Because presumably there were elections for her second term.
That's correct. Yes.
I think it's fascinating. The Weah, of course, has aligned himself with the old forces, hasn't he, with the guy Taylor who's in jail.
In fact, in
a British jail, isn't he?
He's in Durham. Rained upon this afternoon.
George Weah's running mate, Jewel Howard Taylor, is Charles Taylor's ex-wife.
Right. One of many.
Charles Taylor, yes, as you point out, is in Durham jail, doing what I think we can agree is a richly deserved 50-year stretch, is it not? For
50 years, yes, and quite richly deserved. He's not a nice man.
For various war crimes. Is that a concern, though, that there's still any connection with him?
Well, yes, it is a concern. But on the other hand, as Ellen Marsh, she's known as President Sirleaf, told Liberians, you know, this is supposed to be a free, fair election. Vote for your family and your country, not ethnicity. And if Weah wants to stand with whatever friends stand behind him, that's within the rules.
Have you ever met Weah? Because I've only, of course, seen him play, and he was a wonderful footballer.
He was a fabulous footballer.
No doubt about that.
No.
Is he a good politician?
Weah, no. Charles Taylor and Sirleaf, yes. But Sirleaf is charming, extremely competent, articulate woman. Charles Taylor, rather gruff. And I think, you know, long before ISIS videos were invented, the video of his cutting at the ears off his political opponent will linger in the memory for some time.
Mm. I mean, on that, the issue of George Weah as Sebastian, who, as you correctly point out, was a superb football player. But is it a good sign, especially in a budding democracy, that somebody is able to leverage celebrity into a measure of political prominence?
We're waiting for David Beckham to start running for Prime Minister, aren't we? Or Franz Beckenbauer for German president. No, seriously, I mean, I haven't met him. I can't really assess his intelligence. You normally think that footballers with some sense of life beyond the pitch are few and far between, but you know, there are some. He may turn out to be good. Who knows?
Yes, maybe.
Well, he needs to win first. But if we look at what President Sirleaf has accomplished, John, are there exportable lessons there for other countries trying to turn themselves around? Because as you were saying earlier, what the very fact that this process is occurring in Liberia compared to what Liberia was like as recently as the 1990s, early 2000s, is extraordinary.
Yes, it is. Exportables. I think the real lesson that Ellen Sirleaf has taught the world is that just doing the right thing bit by bit, slowly, incrementally, over a period of time has dramatic effects. I mean, when she came, there were hardly any roads in Liberia. There's still a lot of places that need roads and haven't got them, but we know actually we've got the motorway being built into Guinea, creating, apart from anything else, an awful lot of jobs. The healthcare was non-existent. It's now only almost non-existent in most of the country. You can actually get injections some of the time. And there's education. It's not sort of a full set. But year by year, you know, she's raised the school leaving age incrementally, so that now most Liberians are going through the current school system at least come out literate, which, of course, if you're trying to run a democracy, is no small thing.
No doubt that we are rooting for her vice president to be elected, aren't we?
Yes, it's a great pity that she isn't, that she hasn't campaigned for him. I mean, it's not clear why. It looks as if the two have fallen out in some way. I don't think the danger if Weah wins is Weah himself. The danger is Jewel Taylor, Charles Taylor's ex, as you said, who is something of a scheming woman. I mean, she's been around the circuit a few times and has said openly that if Weah wins, then she, because of course she's his running mate, she would press for the old agenda, as she calls it, Charles Taylor's way of doing things, to be brought back, which perhaps is not the best of news for Liberia.
Okay, well, let's look finally to Catalonia, the president of which, Charles Puigdemont, has rather thoughtlessly rescheduled the speech he was due to give about an hour and 22 minutes ago to around about now. See, this was supposed to be our lead item, but, you know, he kept us waiting almost as if he was giving our schedule absolutely no thought whatsoever. This was, and as we go to air, is Puigdemont's first address to Catalonia's parliament since the illegal referendum, which returned a resounding endorsement for independence. However, since the vote, a measure of reality has been injected into the discussion by several largish Catalan employers who have announced plans to relocate elsewhere. Now, he has started speaking. He hasn't as yet tipped his hand about whether he's about to declare independence or not. He has said that he's not planning any threats or insults, which is something, and wants to de-escalate the tension. John, at the risk of asking you to gaze into a crystal ball, and you may be made a complete fool of in about 5 minutes, is he about to bottle it?
I don't know about bottle it. I suspect that he's had a quiet rethink, that various important people, certainly working for Rajoy, and probably also within his own party, have gone alongside him and said, don't do it. Just don't do it. It's going to cause chaos. It is not worth the candle. And there are better ways of moving forward than this. I suspect that the text of that speech that he's looking at has got scribble all over it. Change after change after change. Balloons and virtually illegible script. It must be quite hard to deliver.
Because there was, of course, a delay during which one assumes that quite a lot of frantic conversations were being had among Puigdemont and his people, and also, I guess, between Catalonia's government and the government of Spain. Sebastian, if he is trying to wind it back in a bit, how easy is that going to be? Because once the nationalist toothpaste is out of the tube, it's not easy getting it back in.
And he's got quite a few partners in his coalition who won't at all be happy, will they? I mean, this almost Trotskyite left-wing party, I've just forgotten the name, sorry, but they are hell-bent on independence, so he'll have a tough time of justifying either decision, whether it is independence or not.
That it should come to this. Rajoy,
madness.
If he's not kicking himself, he should be. I mean, we talked just now about Puigdemont to perhaps making a mess of things. I mean, the real culprit is Rajoy. If he had had an ounce of statesmanship, he would have done a deal with the previous right-of-centre Catalan government that was broadly politically of his persuasion, gone to Barcelona, made a generous speech, and you know, addressed the issues at its heart when there were people there who could work with, not have let things get to this stage, not to have let the president of the Catalan government actually move into a parliament where there's a real risk they will announce independence. It was crazy politics.
There was a chance of that in 2012. They were quite close and could have solved the issue for a generation. I mean, it's to be fair to Rajoy, of course, it's a process which has been going on for quite some time before he took over, to water down Catalonia's autonomy, to bring in all sorts of regions in Spain, have their sort of autonomous status, which they never had in the last 300-400 centuries, and thereby giving the Catalans reasons for grievance.
The main reason they have for grievance is that back in 2012, as you rightly say, where the issue was on the top of the table, the Catalans pointed out that what they had fell far short of what the Basque country had, and they wanted parity. And the central government never produced any intellectually coherent reason why the two regions should be treated differently. And Catalan was simply brushed aside. That is what has started the current wave of nationalism, radicalised otherwise moderate opinion, and led to the predicament we're in now.
We're now seeing Mr. Puigdemont is taking a few paragraphs to yell at the behaviour of the Spanish authorities during the referendum on the 1st of October, which I suppose he's perfectly entitled to do. And he said it went wrong. They didn't achieve their objective because more than 2 million people went against that fear. Again, he still hasn't said the I word as we go to air. John, how big a bucket of cold water was the international response in the last few days to the prospect of Catalan independence? France especially just said flat out they would not recognise Catalonia, and more to the point, Catalonia would be tossed out of the EU, presumably never to return.
Which, of course, is a contradiction. I mean, if you can either not recognise Catalonia and just say the whole thing just hasn't happened, or you can recognise it and then say, and you've now, we're throwing you out of the EU. You can't have it both ways. But that doesn't seem to have
occurred. But nonetheless, I mean, it did prompt the question, did it not, Sebastian, of what happens if you declare independence and the entire rest of the world just refuses to acknowledge it?
The European reaction was very interesting, wasn't it? And not entirely to my taste, I have to say, because they totally kept quiet about this really unpleasant scenes of violence. And they could have said, I think they could have been a little bit more emollient about the whole thing. But in the end, of course, Spain is an important fifth largest economy in the Eurozone. Fourth largest, in fact. And so I suppose what Madrid says matters more than anything else.
All that is true. But on top of that, there's the simple legal position that the EU, there's nothing in the EU documents that enables you to go in effectively to a nation state dealing with a question of independence. Remember, we went through all this when we had the Scottish referendum. The EU has no mandate in such matters. It can offer good offices. It can say nice words. It can sort of express concern over sort of excessive policing. But that's about as far as it can go.
They should have done. They should have offered good offices quite a while ago, I would have thought. That's part of the problem. Now, who is going to do it? Somebody has to go in and say, look, guys, how do we move on from this? Shall we send the Swiss, or shall we send a Catholic bishop, or what do we do?
Well, there will doubtless be more on this on the Daily tonight at 2200. well and truly after Mr. Puigdemont has concluded his oration. But for the moment, we are out of time. That brings us to the end of today's show. Sebastian Borger and John Everard, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was David Stevens. There's music next at 1900. It's our design show, Section D. And as I said, more on the day's big stories, including Puigdemont's speech on the daily at 2200 tonight. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. I'll be your host for that as well at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.